To live in the real world is first to understand that there is no solution to the dilemmas of the human condition.
We live in a dangerous world.
Second, it is to understand that to escape these dilemmas, human beings will inevitably embark on desperate quests for redemption in this life,
devising systems mitigating one and two, that dispels disaster for all.
These redemptions, in turn, will require holy wars to purge the world of demons, of those who do not share their faith and who stand in their way. In this regard, totalitarian Islam is really no different in its heart from totalitarian socialism and progressivism. There's a couple of words. Even though the latter are secular and the former is pushed in the name of a vengeful, malignant God. Both seek to cleanse mankind of its irreparable imperfections. To remain free beings, we are continually forced to defend ourselves and our breathing space against the efforts of the redeemers to perfect us, against the armies of the saints who are determined to make the world a better place than it can ever be. Very good, I thought. So the guy's probably not a believer, as far as I know. He's just talking from observing things as it is, and those are the kind of things we've been trying to make a point of here. We do not want to forget in our little session, we are number three today. Three? Yeah, third. We do not want to forget we live in a dangerous world. That means that there are certain things that are going to be impossible, no matter what we do. We also live in a world that is unequal. It will never be equal. I just mentioned this today, thinking about it. How many times in our discussion on the media, or either reading or writing, listening, we hear the word equal or equality. Okay? It is a quest that's ongoing. We live in an unequal world. Cannot be changed. So trying to change this and to change this will cause a disaster for all. So what you going to do? Well, in order to cope, we live by utilize biblical principles, which we are going to cover some of those. We already covered some of those. Most of them are work, something our kids all have to learn. Work, eat your own bread. That's pretty hard, not yours. I don't eat yours, you don't eat mine. Another one, very important, we talked about this. Sleep in your own bed. You get what I mean by that? Take care of your family. And might even say not everybody else's. Take care of your family and obey God's word, then we can put a lot of things underneath that. But there are four principles that we can do pretty much by our choice, and the end result will be that there is a good possibility, no guarantee, that you have a life of contentment. Now, this word we'll find today, the other word for that is happiness. Really a convention, a contrived word that really comes out of our U.S. Constitution. The right to happiness. It's not a right guaranteed in the Bible. What we are guaranteed as believers is contentment. And some might say that no matter what the possibility, what the outcome is, in your life, contentment is always a possibility, no matter how severe life will be for you. Yep, I'm turned on. That's the way things go on tonight. Make sure I don't miss any of it. I let you go early last week. I'm going to try real hard to let you go on time this week. In our third series in our Wonderfully Made of the spring session, I always think about all the run-ups we need to have here to make sure you understand what we're doing. That's why I did this. We don't want to lose track of what we're doing here. Now, we chose this subject this year because it is important. It's important for believers to understand how God intends his creation to function in our social and economic relationships. The basic unit is the family. By the way, the attack is on the family, which is one man, one woman, married, plus the children that are born to them. This forms the primary building block of all cultures, any culture across the world. That's how it works. It is clear that this institution of the family is God-given, and thus it becomes the focus of attack by the arch enemy of our Lord God. In the fallen world, it is essential for the family to provide the necessities for living, which is food, shelter, clothing, protection from enemies, and in Nebraska, the wind. All these require capital, which is another word for money, or in the case of extreme isolation, and we have friends that live in Montana in a dirt house, they have to have a lot of skills to live there by themselves. Either you bring money to buy your stuff or you learn how to do it yourself. The debate rages regarding how capital can be generated or distributed. Shouldn't have a question mark, but that's what it is. Some add to this question a moral component in fairness. Again, that speaks to equality. You know, equality, I never quite know for sure what we're equaling to. Nor do I know for sure when something is fair, because there has to be some standard. So these are kind of fuzzy words that are being kicked around out there. I'm not sure we know what they mean or have definition. Again, our understanding of the Bible is that capital, wealth, that is to buy things, is created by responsible actions of creatures who have abilities to produce something of value. Basic economic thought. This cycle of production and sale and production provides a basic economy, an interchange of money or goods and money. Economics 101. We believe that each family unit has a responsibility to participate in some measure in the economy. That is, they must produce something. We use from 2 Timothy 3:10 and 11 this phrase to capture this essence, eat your own bread. In order to do that, you got to work to make it or to earn it. It's a very, very efficient system. It depends on self-interest. It does not waste time and material on the valueless. We just don't. We're lazy people at heart. If God has instructed us to eat our own bread, is it any wonder that the God of this world would suggest that it is better to eat another person's bread, especially if he has a lot more of it? Surely it would seem to be a better system, more convenient, certainly more efficient, and a whole lot less work, and patently more fair. Or is it? So these inequities are said because we're talking about in a system that does not acknowledge a God. So whatever somebody is unequal in their wealth, they got it as a matter of luck. The second case, the question is posed, how is it that some have more than others? Never mind the notion that someone may have worked harder for it. There must be another reason. As we will see, some see culture itself as the reason for inequities. Those who have more are lucky. Since it was sheer luck, they are not entitled to it. Further, if all had the same amount, then the problems of difficult production, plus the theft, the warring, the jealousy, and so forth would vanish. And then everyone would live happily. Well, I was thinking about Psalm chapter 2, verse 1. Why do the nations, why are they in uproar? Why are the Gentiles in uproar? Why do the people devise a vain thing? And we're in the devising a vain thing here. Because man is, and I say, willfully without the knowledge of God. Thus, he has no explanation for why things are the way they are. We spent 11 weeks of those 12 weeks talking about why things are the way they are. So we had a good grasp on why things are the way they are. We're not surprised when we go outside and we see the wind. We are not surprised. We expected that. Not as much, but we expected the wind. So they have no explanation. So when they profess their wisdom, they are, in essence, called fools. Romans 1:21. So he must thus find causes for the chaos he observes. It is because he has rejected the will of God. Thus, any plan he can intellectualize will be a false one. There are not two right plans. Now we're going to do a little history tonight for you folks. I'm sure that's why you're here. You enjoy history. We're making a lot of it, okay? In the days after the French Revolution, which entered in 1789, French philosopher Francis Babet, I don't know how to say his name. Some of you are French, you can tell me. He lived a ripe age of 47 years. Not quite 37 years. Somebody else has been 40. Okay. He lived 37 years. Decided that ownership of private property, which caused unequal wealth, must be outlawed to finish the revolution. You know, he was during the revolution, lived through the revolution, and he saw that they didn't go far enough. Babet was the head of the conspiracy of equals. You can look that up on the internet, read all about it. His placard read, which they carried around, "Nature has given to every man the right to the enjoyment of an equal share of all property." Babet believed as long as there were haves and haves not, there would be want in the poor and an exploitation by the rich of the poor. This inequity kept people from happiness. Babet was a rich, poor man, exploiting other people's wealth, and he did that. Yet he was still very unhappy. The French did not agree with his assessment, so they executed him by the guillotine. That's one way to shut him up, but you know the way it is. It doesn't work that well anymore. So the possibility of happiness, a newfound idea, in the American Constitution, 1776, has this little phrase in it: pursuit of happiness. Heretofore, it was not a quantifiable commodity. If Babet's happiness became a government, for Babet, happiness became a government guaranteed idea, even if it was a manufactured expectation. Now, in the U.S. Constitution, the preamble says, where it comes from, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." That's where the word is. While the Americans aimed to protect the pursuit of it, the French revolutionists wanted to guarantee the thing itself. So to free to pursue happiness is quite different than to guarantee happiness, similar to our expressions in our quest for righteousness. Similarly, to pursue righteousness is very different than possessing righteousness. All of a sudden, pursuit equals a promise or a right. These seeds sprouted in the wake of the French Revolution in the mind of Francis Babet. Now, it's hard to know whether the philosophical altruism comes from genuine concern for the poor, which is always the way it's presented, or whether it is a selfish wish regarding how things ought to be to avoid work and responsibility, which is true for Babet, because he borrowed from people, lived off their wealth. It is noteworthy that these ideas often come from men who, in many cases, never held a job for long or produced anything of marketable value. Now, we have some exceptions. But for the shapers of socialism, and another word for that is communism, it was easier to beg, borrow, and steal than to do productive work. Robert Owen, we'll talk about him tonight a lot. Next week, we'll talk about Frederick Engels. Both of those men are glaring exceptions. Both of those men had ability, and they created a pile of wealth. For those who had a genuine concern to make life better or happier, there was another conviction shared with many of the lazy philosophers, and they are all lazy philosophers, that was the absolute destruction of the Christian religion. For many, it was just religion, but Christianity was the only religion of any consequence. So whenever they talk about religion, it always was Christianity. And a lot of times, the Catholic version of it. Robert Owen said, and we'll focus on him tonight, he said, There is no sacrifice which I would not have willingly and joyously made to terminate the existence of religion on earth. He goes on, after reflecting childhood upon the great diversities of faith, Owen concluded that all were based on the same absurd imagination that each person determined in his own thoughts, will, and action, and was responsible for them to God and his fellow men. That idea. This faulty notion, he said, turned men into a weak, imbecile animal, a furious bigot and fanatic, or a miserable hypocrite. I guess that covers it. So we say the principles and the points of attack are the necessity to work, the likeliness of iniquities, which legitimizes property ownership, and the necessity of facing God in judgment. I must act responsibly. In our studies, we have called the humanistic economic system socialism because the focus of the system is to manage the socioeconomic relationships. Communism is also a word that expresses sharing valuable things together in a community or as in a commune. Sometimes you capitalize it, sometimes you don't. If it's a particular version of it, then you capitalize it. And if it's not, it's a small c. So most of the time, up till now, we've been talking small c. Now the seminal error means the beginning error, the foundational error of socialism is a focus on the community, hence communism, versus individual. So the duty of a person is to the community versus the duty of the individual in self-interest. Now, again, we include individual, the family. In socialism and communism, community yes, the individual no. And you even hear that today, there's a lot less, especially among the Christian discussions with the departing Christians, are saying there's way, way too much emphasis on individual salvation. Okay, that's the idea. We need to talk more about, they don't want to say group salvation, but we're in this together. You start hearing it. It's the same kind of flavor. Now note, self-interest is understood to include one's family. Robert Owen, as we see him, we'll see him soon, thought to expunge the existing individual selfish system and substitute for a better united social one. He believed that the emphasis on the individual leads to destructive selfishness. The community must assume the responsibility to change the old focus on the self and move it to the community. Once the community focus has been corrected, it will produce individuals of high moral character. Now, my hopes are really up. But which first? No human is responsible for his will, he says, and for his own actions. His whole character, physical, mental, moral, is formed independently of himself. Each person is entirely the product of his constitution or organization at birth, had nothing to do with that, by the way, and the effect of the external circumstances upon it from birth to death. We are victims flying through space. Therefore, it is futile to call individuals to account for their behavior. We're talking about Babeuf here. Instead, society should recognize its community's power to shape each of its members into a person of high character. So we have the seminal errors. First of all, the individual is responsible for his failing self. That's the truth. He can blame no one for his deplorable condition except himself. We have many verses, Romans 3:10, there's none righteous, no, not one. All have sinned, come short of the glory of God, 3:23. Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart is the most deceitful than anything else and desperately wicked. Who can understand it? Conversely, the community cannot make a person of high moral character. If the community does anything, it drives the individual into further sin. Think about Lot when he lived in Sodom and Gomorrah. It didn't make him a better man, did it? It could not rescue him. Proverbs 14:12 says, but there is a way that seems right to man, but the end of it, when the end is the way of death. So the community void of God's enlightenment will devise an evil plan. Proverbs 6:18, the heart is to devise wicked plans, and feet run rapidly to evil. Romans 1:25 talks about they exchange the truth of God for a lie. We've been seeing that in our study. And they worship the creature rather than the creator. So socialism starts with pardoning the individual for his crimes, for his sins. His crimes are the fault of the community. Thus, his punishment should not be severe or have any punitive motivation or retribution. Only rehabilitation. You can't rehabilitate a dead man, they say. They say the collective community is to be held to account for the crimes of these individuals. Perhaps a crafty idea, but how do you indict a community? Who in the community is responsible? Since sins cannot be assigned to the truly responsible persons, a truly responsible person, the crime goes unpunished, justice is denied, society suffers, and misery is compounded by more injustice, cycling downward, see Romans 1, 18 through 20, 32. No one's to blame. Well, it is not difficult to see that if a community is not producing members of high moral character, that something is wrong. And there certainly were a lot missing in the French Revolution. So the logic goes like this. A low moral person can be traceable to unhappy people. Private property makes people unhappy. Eliminate private property and people will be happy again, producing high moral character. Now, those are pretty good leaps there, I think. Remember, we've rejected what's true, so we have to go with anything that might work. So commonly held property, from these storehouses, it is said, Babeuf, he's saying this, from these storehouses, the goods would be distributed equitably by the superiors. I'm always thinking, Hold it. We got equity and now we got superiors. I think there is a problem here. And the writer goes on to mention this. Apparently there was a cadre of superiors in this oh so equal world. There was to be universal compulsory useful work serving the fatherland. Teachers or scientists must submit certifications of loyalty to the superiors. Teachers must teach their socialist agenda. The manifesto, which ended up being what they are called, acknowledges that there would be an enormous expansion of government officials and bureaucrats in the communist world, inevitably where the father hand takes control of an individual from his birth until his death. So they understand there has to be another layer of people all in this equal. Goes on how this would work. All meals would be taken in public in every commune, and there would be, of course, there would, of course, be compulsory attendance for all community members. Furthermore, everyone could only obtain his daily ration in the district in which he lives. The only exception would be when he was traveling with permission of the administration. All private entertainment would be strictly forbidden, lest imagination released from the supervision of a strict judge should engender abominable vices contrary to the commonweal. And as for religion, all so-called revelation ought to be banned by law. So if you're going to go into another state, you'd have to get permission to do that, because you'd have to eat their food and you have to have permission to do that. It gets to be quite something. As Babeuf called out at the conclusion of his manifesto, may everything return to chaos, and out of chaos may there emerge a new and regenerated world. Now, that's another little principle in order to make these steps. We'll see this more when we get down into Lenin and Stalin, where there had to be chaos in order to come out with something. You can't just go from good to good. You have to go from good to bad. Not anybody's ready to do anything better. So you've got to go through that chaos cycle. Remember, we're talking 1800s here, late 1700s. May everything return to chaos, and out of chaos may there emerge a new and regenerated world. Indeed, the Plebeian Manifesto, published slightly earlier than the Manifesto of Equals in November 1795, was the first in a line of revolutionary manifestos that would reach a climax in Marx's Communist, capital C, Manifesto about a half century later. Now, a secret conspiratorial inner circle, a phalanx of professional revolutionaries, Inevitably, this meant that Babeuf's strategic perspective for his revolution involved some fascinating paradoxes. For the name of a goal of harmony and perfect equality, the revolutionaries were to be led by a hierarchy commanding total obedience. The inner cadre would work its will over the masses. An absolute leader heading an all-powerful cadre would be the power that would be the proper at the proper moment give the signal to usher in a society of perfect equality. It's just kind of interesting thought here about George Orwell when he wrote, when 1984 was a long way ahead until we see it in a rearview mirror now, but there was this fear about 1984 because of what's going to happen to our world, according to this fiction writer, but he also kind of a philosopher, seer. He says, if you want a vision of the future, imagine boot stamping on your human face forever. That's kind of what was expected when this stuff would actually finally materialize. And we have a little bit of time now with history in hindsight. So no private property, the conspiracy that equals proclaimed. A revolution would be made at the end of all further revolutions. There would be revolutions and then finally a final one. An all-powerful hierarchy would be necessary allegedly to put an end to the hierarchy forever. But of course, as we have seen, there was no real paradox here, no intention to eliminate hierarchy. The peons to equality were a flimsy camouflage for the real objective of permanently entrenched and absolute dictatorship of Orwell's striking image, a boot stamping on a human face forever. Okay, summary. No one is responsible for his criminal or sinful acts, stands against what the Bible says, since they are traceable to the environment and the community. The Bible does not support that. We are responsible. Happiness is possible only if there is equality. Not such a thought in the Bible. Equality is possible only if all property is held in common. Again, not supported in the Scripture. Since the individual cannot hold property rights, the community assumes the control of it. Again, not in the Scripture. And you might argue sometime along the way here about what Israel functioned. Their function was a little differently, but they were never socialistic. In fact, they had some rules that they lived by, but they were never socialistic. Now, that modern-day Jews have tried that, and in the end of our study someday, we'll talk about the kibbutzes in Israel, and they did not work. Okay, to produce the people of high moral character, the faulty notion of man being accountable to God is from a weak, imbecile animal, a furious bigot and fanatic, or a miserable hypocrite. We had that already. Now, if you want to read more about this, I highly recommend this book. It's written by a Jewish fellow. So many of these people are Jewish, and I was going to make a point of that tonight, how many of these people that write and have insight into these things are Jewish, and some of them that have made the biggest mistakes in life are Jewish. Interesting how that works out. But this book's called Heaven on Earth, The Rise and Fall of Socialism. And I picked it up when I was in Dallas 1 year, 2005 or 2006, something like that, and it was this book laying there. And Heaven on Earth, Rise and Fall. That's an interesting book. It was 50% off, so I bought it. It's been one of my best buys, and I always contribute to the Lord, give him the credit for it, because I wouldn't have found it. So it's very easily read and very helpful. So if you want to read more about what I'm talking about tonight, you'd like to get this book. And it's also on Kindle for about $10. So you have to buy that big and carry it around and put it on your shelf. You have it in your Kindle. Okay. Heaven on Earth at New Harmony, Indiana, A Rise and Fall of Socialism. We're going to use his text, and I'm going to read quite a bit to you tonight. And I want to do this because if I just tell you about certain things, I want to just show you how this actually worked out. It is a story of a man's most ambitious attempt to supplant religion with a doctrine about how life ought to be lived that claims grounding in science rather than religion. If we trace the idea of socialism, not coined till after 1825, we may start even as far back as Plato. We're not going to do that. It is noteworthy that there are no successful outcomes where socialistic principles have been adopted with any degree of success, get this, even though by 1970, 60% of the world lived under some form of socialism. Remember the statistic of last week showing that nearly 100 million people died, and many more due to the policies of socialism in the world. In all this loss, there was and is no glowing successes. Take off the S, not even one. We know about Francis Babeuf in France, whose post-revolutionary socialistic ideas brought him to the guillotine without his ideas ever being tested. Even the emancipated revolutionary French could see his flaws. After a 2-month trial, Babeuf's career ended as a lazy philosopher and who finally gave way to the ultimate natural order called death. Socialism from 1825 to 1970 was modified again and again, sometimes for ulterior motives, but also because for its unmatched allure. There's something about this that is so attractive that it's almost diabolical. But it proves maddeningly difficult to implement. I guess that's kind of what the moth thought when he flew around the flame. I love the flame, but how do I get close to it without getting burned? Okay, had the simple insight we just read been heeded by the world, it would have saved them from a great deal of suffering. But once the truth is set forth by God, by the God who cares, is ignored, the sinful heart will stop at nothing to prove God's way is wrong. I remember years ago, one such fool lamenting that socialism was such a good thing, too bad it didn't work. And I might say he might have thought, too bad that God was right and that man was wrong, kind of what he was saying. Now we have the Owens and Marx connection. These, including Owens' experiments in socialism, did not turn out well, and the idea itself might have wasted away in infancy had it not been taken up by a symbiotic team of unique prophetic power, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. We'll do that next week. Some water. I do this little chart like that to keep track of things, but I don't want to stop in time to do this, but we basically start from the French Revolution. And communism fell, Russia version of it, fell in 1991. So we could say basically 2 years of madness. Remember, we said nowhere has this experiment ever succeeded, except that it destroyed countless lives. Remember, God is a God who cares. It matters when this stuff happens. So we have Babeuf, we have Robert Owen, we have Engels, we have also, we're going to talk a little bit about Edward Bernstein, then we have Lenin and Stalin, then we have Khrushchev ending up with Gorbachev that put the last touches on the Soviet Union. In the meantime, in Russia alone, 20 million people died. Okay, Robert Owen wanted to shake off religion, remember, inequities as causes for conflict and unhappiness. Owen lived far away in Scotland, was a talented child prodigy. He was out of his house by like 10, when he was 10 years old. He was a prodigy. And he turned industrialist as a young kid, even in his early teens. Tremendously gifted person. And by the way, if I don't forget to say it, I'll say it now, that his children did not adopt his ideas. And they all became super successful people, like one of them founded the Smithsonian Institute, another one. These kind of high-level people. So this guy was a brilliant person. So he was a talented child prodigy, turned industrialist, producing cotton, woven goods by large mills, employed many people, including very young children. In Scotland, in a rare moment of history, Robert Owen used his own money, that's the rare part, to launch a social experiment in the New World at Harmony, Indiana, which he named New Harmony. Owen announced that he had purchased a large developed tract on the banks of the Wabash in Indiana, on which he would organize a model community to prove to the world the benefits of the social system and thereby usher in the, borrow the biblical word, millennium. Here it is, in the heart of the United States, that the power which directs, he says, there is a power that directs and governs the universe, that every action of man has arranged circumstances to prevent me, pull me, to commence a new empire of people and goodwill to man, founded on other principles and leading to other practices and than those of the past or present, in which principles in due season, in the allotted time, will lead to that state of virtue, intelligence, employment, happiness, and practice, which has been foretold by the sages, I don't know who he meant, in past times, would at some distant period become the lot of the human race. The only one that exceeded like that sentence is the Apostle Paul. In other words, he's going to create a virtual millennium kingdom utopia on earth. And he's not going to use any of the stuff of the past. What are the things of the past? The stuff out of Christianity. Well, Beth's surviving co-conspirator, Bonaretti, or I practiced his name before, it's Bonaretti, noted with satisfaction that what the Democrats would be like in France, and in the year, I was going to look up the year four, I don't know what that is, because a lot of these revolutions, they started the calendars over with the revolution. So maybe that's what's meant here. Year four would be like 1793, yeah, I don't know if that's a year or not. Was enabled to execute in France a generous man from generous man as recently essayed by other means to put in practice in America communities founded on the principles of equal distribution of employments and labor. So he's thinking it's a good idea. Bob F. by now is dead. He's assumed room temperature, as they say. While Babeuf could imagine what equality in all things might look like, he had no way of knowing how to implement the ideal. He already was living on extorted money. Further, the French, seeing his idea, no private property equality, so contrary to human nature, they simply executed him. So that question of how to implement the idea was settled for Bonaretti when the industrialists of notable wealth without the cooperation of the government or other people's money bought a community to implement socialist experiment. I'd say, rah, 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 go do it. Owen designed the villages down to the last detail, even had a scale model built. Each village was to accommodate 1,200 people. The buildings were to be arranged in the shape of a parallelogram, three sides of which would consist of flats with one room allotted to each married couple and the very young children. The fourth side would comprise dormitories for all the children over the age of three, and an infirmary and a guest house. In the middle would be schools and dining halls and kitchens, since all meals would be taken communally. Gardens and playhouses would surround these central buildings. Owen even prescribed the dress of the villagers, favoring loose garments like the Roman togas or the Scottish kilts. He left no rock unturned. Now these villages would take men and women and children of all ages and capacities and dispositions. Most of them were ignorant, many with bad and vicious back habits, and transform them into superior beings. Remember, that's his objective here. So he can take anybody and make them new. I think the only one that can do that is the Lord. But then he doesn't believe in the Lord, so he's got to do it. They would live together in the closest harmony, intimately acquainted with each other's inmost thoughts. Can you see their heads together? And would produce enough to provide for themselves abundantly. As Owen developed the idea, he envisioned a life of virtually effortless abundance. Villagers would proceed from birth through 3 5-year stages to education, preparing them to become, at the age 15, men and women, and then to marry, or whatever they wanted to do. He wasn't all that hot about marriage. And a new race, physically, intellectually, morally, being superior, far superior to any yet known to have lived upon the earth. That's quite a statement. That's quite an ambitious idea. Wouldn't you want to join that? Well, when people were raised in these villages, the human race would change, he would say. And not only the people, there will be no cruelty in man's nature, even toward the other creatures. As a result, the animal creation will also become different in their character. You see men, millennial winds blowing through this guy's ideas? More species would be domesticated, and those that could not be tamed would be destroyed, so that a terrestrial paradise will be formed in which harmony will pervade in all that will exist upon the earth. Socialism promised to a surfeit, which is abundance, of material goods and brotherly harmony among people and pigs. But the ultimate reward would be the transformation of humans. The ultimate reward would be the transformation of humans. If not into gods, then into supermen, able to transcend the pains and the limits of life as it had been known. Here we go again. Owen was confident that the great transition to the terrestrial paradise could be achieved by the force of example. Once one of the several villages of unity and cooperation would have a chance to demonstrate their success, other people would be eager to emulate them and join them in their Garden of Eden. But all this was a dream, even in Scotland, where he would find the same opposition Babeuf encountered in France. He needed a clean slate to start over. So when the whole community became available for purchase in America, it was as if the gods were smiling on him. At last now to launch not an experiment, but the reality itself of the perfected utopia, untainted by former prejudices. By the way, you have a picture of those Lanark mills in Scotland where Robert Owen practiced his ideas. Now, when he ran his company, he did not run them as a socialist. He ran them as an industrialist, but he took very good care of his people. But it wasn't socialism. Not at all. Well, a sect of German Lutheran schismatics, can't imagine that, led by a charismatic preacher named George Rapp, lived communally since immigrating from Wittenberg in 1804 from Germany. The Harmony Society, as they fashioned themselves, had built a flourishing community in Butler County, Pennsylvania in 1814. Something inspired Rapp to move his flock to Indiana and found a new community which was Christian New Harmony, i.e. Here, in addition to bringing forth verdant fields, orchards, vineyards, and on 4,000 acres of rich soil they cleared, they built highly remunerative industries which produced an array of textiles, clothing, shoes, lumber, bricks, cooking oil, candles, glue, beer, and whiskey. You always got to have that. Now, don't be confused here with these sects that are living communally. You know, there's something that brought them together. It wasn't that, see, what Robert Owen was doing, he's going to take everybody, the worst, and put them together and make them. Here we got, if we got a communal group living like these guys did, like they were Lutherans, the common faith is what brought them together. And to some extent, they practiced their socialism that way, at least in a communal way. Okay, after 10 years, prompted by some new revelation, Rapp determined to move his band once again. He found somebody to sell the land, so Robert Dale, son of Robert Owen, recalled that there was a village ready built, a territory capable of supporting tens of thousands in a country where the expression of thought was free. But the people were unsophisticated, the time had come for the great experiment. In April 27, 1825, Owen assembled the new arrivals for a welcoming speech. He says, "I have come to this country to introduce an entire new state of society," he said, "to change it from the ignorant, selfish system to an enlightened social system which shall gradually unite all interests into one and remove all causes for contest between individuals." And he concluded solemnly, "I now live to see this system fairly established in this world." He visioned that this is a three-year transitional phase to a truly cooperative, egalitarian community. For the short term, some elements of inequality were allowed to endure. We talked about that. When the 2 months of greeting his new follower, Owen, departed, entrusting command to his son, William, and to a British disciple named Donald MacDonald. Can you imagine having two of the same names? He had some business affairs to attend to in Scotland, but mostly he spent his time making speeches in America. And some of those was before our president. You heard him out at that time. Owen's decision to leave the fledgling community at this time defies understanding. Not only were all of his hopes and visions invested in it, but also the preponderance of his fortune. He funded this thing. The only conceivable explanation is that he was so certain of the validity of his theories that he had not entertained the possibility that it might fail. In fact, he died thinking it was a success. Williams writes, the son, "The enjoyment of a reformer, I should say, is much more in contemplation than in reality." You know, anticipation is better than reality. "I did not expect that those who were brought up in a community will enjoy more happiness than I anticipated for myself, and more than they can experience who have been brought up and live under the old mode of society. I should not be disposed to promote the formation of a society as I at present am inclined to doubt whether the happiness of the present generation will be increased. He didn't believe his dad. The village purchased from RAP contained 1,600 buildings, and I'm going to go ahead and frame buildings and so forth. You can see pictures of it, and the lady that's there probably is one of the survivors. No, she's just a modern visitor who is trying to be one of them, I guess. Inside one of these houses, in fact, we have Jane Blafier Owen leaving her 200-year-old New Harmony home. Apparently, she is a descendant of him. That's interesting. However, since Owenites outnumbered the Rappites by several hundred, Williams, at his wit's end, finding sufficient sleeping quarters for all. The place was too small. Moreover, despite the surfeit of population, there was nonetheless a shortage of labor. This was felt most markedly in the colony's various industries, every one of which experienced a fallout in output and several of which ceased operation altogether. Historian so forth traces this collapse to a dream of skilled workmen and supervisors, few of whom were attached to New Harmony. Were their compensation would have been less than in the surrounding community economy. So they just left. In a letter home to one of his brothers, William bemoaned the lack of any potter, ager, would that be meat, beer, who ages, saddler, or good tinner among the New Harmonians. Owen did think to provide some differential material rewards for some, especially the educated professors, but there's no bonuses for anybody. Owenites did not manage to plant sufficient crops that spring. Remember, they came in the summer of 1885. On the vast fertile lands they had purchased, they didn't plant crops or to adequately protect those that they did plant. Paul Brown, who wrote a book about his delusion with Owen, reports the garden and the fields were almost entirely neglected. Thomas Pierce, another whose correspondence survives, wrote during the late summer, "The hogs have been our lords and masters this year in the field and in the garden. They even keep the pigs out of the garden." We knew that in our boys at home. We kept the pigs out of the garden. "We are now, as we have seen, without vegetables except what we buy, and I believe that we shall go without potatoes, turnips, or cabbages this winter." In September, Pierce wrote that until lately, our committee gave up all idea of farming until Mr. Owen would return. Now, can you imagine that, the loss? Waiting for your boss to return? Except the sowing of 50 to 60 acres of winter barley, which they wisely concluded would be they wanted for their beer. The ensuing year, I guess self-interest does sort of kick in eventually. In apparent desperation, he, as Piers, and several other agriculturists met and drafted a resolution to immediately ascertain the situation of the land which is to receive the crops of winter grain, including its location and whether it was subject to any time of flooding, also to determine what number of horses, oxen are in the possession of the society. They didn't even know that. And what number of wagons and plows and tools and plows, harrows, axes, spades, so forth, are now possessed by us? Well, this information any ordinary farmer would gather on one day, but in New Harmony, all the farmers could not, all they could do is form a consensus or a caucus. And Piers reported that a resolution to do this languished. Even the committee couldn't do it. They'd go out and count, but whatever. So the prevailing inefficiency of New Harmony extended to its distribution system. Each member of the community had a passbook in which his hours of labor were credited and the supplies taken down from the village store were debited. Apparently all consumables were supposed to be dispersed that way. Even salads were deposited in the store to be handed out, and making 10,000 necessary steps and causing them to come back to the tables with wilted, deadened state. That's the lettuce, is wilted, deadened state. Okay. The store is literally constantly thronged by consumers with their little books. The storekeepers and clerks seem abundantly busy in attending to them, and although there are so many persons officiating behind the counter, it is frequently very difficult for country people to obtain attention. It seems to me an expensive system, plenty of storekeepers, clerks, committee men, and rangers, few smiths, artisans, and farmers. bureaucratic indistribution, New Harmony survived only because Owen subsidized it, pouring in some $30,000 those first months. That's a lot more money than it is today. In addition to the cost of his purchases from RAP, even the subsidy was not enough to raise the standard of living above a Spartan level. Ron complained in a letter to his friends planning to join them in New Harmony, says, urge them to bring items that they were in short supply, including ham, which, you know, where pigs are running out, but you're supposed to bring your own ham, despite complaints about the pigs. Further, a pilfering disposition very much prevailed. Scarce a week passed, but shirts, handkerchiefs, or stockings were filched, is that the right word, from out of, filched out of the laundries or yards of the boarding houses. People start to take into thievery. For 2 weeks, New Harmony was alive with meetings and drafting sessions culminating in February 5, 1926 with the adoption of the new constitution of the New Harmony Community of Equality. Everybody is excited about this new thing. Days after the permanent constitution was implemented, the first group broke away. Second group breaks away. Third group breaks away. In the main community, Owens undertook a reorganization to elicit more work and responsibility from its members. By the way, you go back under McClure, Owen was given dictatorial control over the colony. Okay, now this goes, I don't have time for this anymore, but back in the days when he was doing the milling in Scotland, he had over every person's workstation, he had a little block, apparently about that high, and had four sides on it, painted every side a different color. And apparently your neighbor saw you do good work, he turned the block according to the kind of work you were doing. So he'd walk into the room and see all these colors, and you know whether his group was working or not, or to what level it was working. So he took that idea here, so a record was kept of these intendants' opinion of the daily character of each person attached to their occupation, that he's thinking about these blocks. Then at the public meetings, get this now, at the public meetings each Sunday, Owen would read aloud the character rating and the amount of work performed of each member of the society. Not working too good here. Got to do something to motivate them. The schools which functioned under McClure's aegis were also a source of mixed satisfaction. We're going to skip this because I'm running out of time. But that was became a big conflict because the school was supposed to now educate the children to live this way, and it wasn't getting done. The kids talked about good bread once a week on Saturdays. I thought if I ever go out, I would kill myself eating sugar and cake. We marched in military order. We went to bed at sundown in our little bunk suspended over the rows by cords from the ceilings. And this guy, gal, whoever is righteous, said they were lined up in a bunk like this, so you had these little suspended balls you hit, you know, boom, boom, they just, you know, well, that's to do with the bunks. They start up. I mean, just kids playing, but they lived in a big group. So children regularly in the boarding house were not allowed to see the parents, except on rare individuals. I saw my mother and father twice in 2 years. And by the way, that's what killed the kibbutz in Israel. They kept the children from the parents. And mother said, not in my house. And it collapsed the kibbutzes. I know they still have them there, but anyway, talk about later. In May, now we're 2006, almost a year into it, things were felt to be faltering to the extent that Owen attempted another reorganization of the community, this time allowing suggestions by McClure. He subdivided some of the workers. Got to go over this. Now, then 1826, July 4, kind of capping off on the independence celebration of America. He wasn't too much American, he's more Scottish. Owen delivered an oration that he believed would be the best as important, at least as important to prosperity as the Declaration of Independence. He called it the Declaration of Mental Independence. And in it he declared that man, up to this hour, has been in all parts of the earth a slave to a trinity of the most monstrous evil that could be combined to inflict mental and physical evil upon his whole race. Private or individual property, absurd and irrational systems of religion and marriage founded on individual property combined with some of these irrational systems of religion. See, he's going on a rant again. Owen argued that the institution of marriage was unnatural and rendered prostitution unavoidable because men and women have not been formed with power to create their own feelings. It is blasphemy against the laws of nature for a man or woman to make any promises or engagements relative to their future feelings. You never know what you're going to feel like tomorrow. You may not want to be married tomorrow, so don't get yourself bound into a marriage. In Owen's view, real chastity consisted not in abstinence from sex, but the abstinence from sex without affection. Is that kind of what we hear these days? Oh, sex itself is wrong, but if there's love, then it's okay. In the winter, 26-27, Owen attempted a fifth and last reorganization, breaking the community down to smaller communities. Didn't work. The final blow in New Harmony was an angry falling out between Owen and McClure, his educator. One of the chief causes of Owen's sudden plan to institute a program of mass education at New Harmony for adults and children alike consisted of three thrice-weekly lectures, and McClure took that as a challenge to his authority, blew them up. So the end not only is near, but it's here, May 1827. Remember, we started in the summer of 25. We're not 2 years into this. Before departing once again for England, Owen delivered a farewell address to New Harmony, claiming triumph over the project. The social system is now firmly established. I could not but feel an almost inexpressible delight from reflecting upon the obstacles which have been overcome, he said. But with Owen gone, the bickering among the followers intensified. A few drifted away and others turned to private pursuits. Owen's attribution of New Harmony's failure to the character of its residents was often repeated, and it has echoed down throughout the historiography of the experience. In other words, whatever Owen said happened is what they repeat, that it was a success, but it wasn't a success, it was outright abject failure. In short, Owen's argument was circular. Socialism, he said, would produce a new man. Until then, all people were necessarily products of the old system. If it required people reared under socialism to create socialism, then how could you get there from here? My point, I said earlier, if you are to produce a society, how can society be changed to produce a better product? I mean, you start with faulty products to begin with. Robert David Owen and his son, all cooperative schemes which provide equal remuneration to the skilled and the industrious and the ignorant and idle must work their own downfall. For by this unjust plan of remuneration, they must of necessity eliminate the valuable members who find their services reaped by the indigent and retain only improvident, unskilled, and vicious members. Then they lose the good ones, they keep the bad ones, they have nothing. Maybe I can do this. This is kind of out of our early America, but how our founders at least had a little better insight into the condition of man. It doesn't make them believers, but they saw life as it really is. While the son's explanation was quite different from the father's, both pointed to the same underlying question. Was socialism suited to men as they were, tailoring instructions to human nature? Was the guiding motive American founders? In the Federalist Papers, Madison observed famously that government was necessary because men were not angels, and that controls of government were necessary because those who governed were not angels. Had Madison commented on socialism, he might have come up with an analogous paradox. If men were angels, then an economy might succeed without selfish incentives. But if men were angels, it would not matter whether the economy succeeded, since they would not have material needs. Kind of like funny. But alas, men are not angels. And it was a socialist's unique departure to attempt to uplift through an economic rather than a spiritual system. The point was, in fact, made by the onset of Owen's experiment by George Rapp in a letter to his son. It goes with these people as with the Jews at the time of Jesus. They were seeking and want a sensuous kingdom of God and not a spiritual one. And I say we might correct that, spiritual one, because we would still believe in a sensuous kingdom of God, but it's not one that's produced by men on earth. It's still coming. The failure of New Harmony cost Robert Owen much of his fortune, but it did not shake his faith in his ideas. Remember, once you're committed to an error, you're committed to an error. It doesn't matter how bad it looks. He paid it little more attention than he paid to the argument for his adversaries. In his autobiography, he devoted a total of three sentences to the entire New Harmony venture, commenting that he found the population of the states far too undeveloped at that period for the practice of a full and true social life. So little was Owen fazed by the denunciation of the New Harmony experiment that within months of returning to Britain, he took it in mind to persuade the government of Mexico to grant him Texas as a site to renew his experiment on a grander scale. He almost had them talked into getting 150 miles of Mexico along the Rio Grande, and obviously that fell through. But why would things have been different? I would have failed too. Well, anyway, around the time he turned 80, still vigorous, founder of the Rational Society, embraced spiritualism. That is the practice of communicating with the dead through the assistance of mediums. In his seances, Owen communed with many of the famous people who he had known, including Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, whom he dubbed as my friend and warm disciple, although in life Jefferson had a sharp criticism of Owen's ideas. Despite the turn to spiritualism, Owen never wavered in his opposition to the superstition of religion. In 1858, at the age of 87, his powers clearly failing, he died. The failure of New Harmony and the other Owenite colonies that had never provided proved fatally discouraging. Instead, they have pointed socialists back to the direction of political action. The hope that a model socialism could be constructed in isolation from the surrounding community had been dashed. Now, you have to do it in a broader sense. Socialism would have to be achieved by the transformation of society as a whole, and you know where we're going. All right, so we have New Harmony. This was the building. He brought his architect over, and this is what they conjured up and never got built. It says this new moral world, Owen's envisioned successor of New Harmony. Owenites fired bricks to build it, but the construction never took place. Looks quite interesting, doesn't it? So here's our link. The Hall of Science in Manchester, England had the inscription in large block letters, "Sacred to the investigation of truth," unquote. It held 3,000 people and it was filled each Sunday by adherents of Robert Owen's New Moral World. Now, he's not dead yet. I'm not sure he's speaking there, but his adherents. Throughout 1843, the congregation included a 22-year-old German journalist named Friedrich Engels, and he will be a very big influence on Karl Marx, or vice versa. So that's the link into next week.